Marguerite Patton, Bill 2.
I was asked to report to Cambridge for my first job as senior home economist in the Ministry of Food. Perhaps I should explain how food advice centres were organised. They were all over Britain, and in charge of them was an organiser. And her job, of course, was to make sure that the people under her did the very best to help the public. Now, what was our job? Our job really covered many, many things. It was to make sure that people knew about the rations. That was number one. Secondly, that people had help in making use of unrationed foods. Thirdly, that where people were entitled to extras, cod liver oil, extra milk, extra cheese in some cases, they knew about it and they could get it or find out how to get it. So really we were the link between the Ministry of Food, the grand people who wrote the articles in papers and urged the public to do this or that, and the public. I reported on, I think, a Friday, yes, and I was given a few addresses to go and find somewhere to lay my head. And the organiser said to me, first of all, on Monday, get here early, because you really want plenty of time to put up your stall in an ideal place. I beg your pardon. She said, yes, your first demonstration will be in the market stall. I, being young and stupid, immediately got very dignified, or tried to be, and said, I've never demonstrated cookery on a market square. And she said, oh, well, this is your chance to begin. Of course, I needed that reproach. And that is where I gave my very first demonstration to the Ministry of Food. I want you to imagine a typical market. On one side of me, on that first Monday morning, it changed, of course, on other days, was a gentleman selling greengrocery. On the other side was a lady selling bric-a-brac. Because by 42, some people were setting up home and short of china and things like that. So a store where you could buy cheap china, even if it didn't match, would be marvellous. And there was I in the middle. Well, the stallholders knew exactly how to extol their wares. Roll up, lovely fresh cauliflower. Got some nice saucers and cups here. So of course, that, I always say, is where I developed a good fairground voice. Oldham in the theatre had helped, because it was fourpence if you sat in the gallery there. That was the old fourpence, which would be less than 2p today. And if you didn't speak up in Oldham, they'd shout out, you speak up, love. But that didn't help as much as the market squares in Cambridge. I think I was thrown to the wolves a little bit because I was a senior a home economist there. And so I had to show how to do it for my other colleagues. So I had to find out how to deal with the market square first of all. I didn't do a lot there, I must confess. I gave demonstrations in welfare clinics, in hospital, outpatients department. That was always a little nerve-wracking because you'd start on your demonstration or you'd start on talking about the value of various foods. And along would come a British nurse, come along mothers, and so you had to start all over again. That was like a non-stop performance. We also went into local factories and talked to people in their lunch hour. And that was difficult because one of the things the government have urged factories to do, to have music while you work, it was to chivvy people along and make them feel happy. And of course, the wartime songs were very cheerful songs. And so you had wartime songs or music. Then you had the clatter of knives and forks. Then you had people chattering because, they, after all, it was their lunchtime. Why shouldn't they chatter? And so somehow you had to get your message across all of that. So, you see, it wasn't really easy in those days. But I think we really did a good job of work. I also went to Ipswich and opened an advice centre and rang that for the Ministry of Food. Now, I must backtrack a little bit. Because all these things happened simultaneously and I got married. early in 1942. So here was I in Cambridge. There was my husband flying by now Lancasters and going on bombing raids. And I used to get back to Lincoln to see him as often as I could. And I must just recall one of the journeys I went back from Cambridge to Lincoln. We'd arranged to meet in a local pub in Waddington, which was a gathering for everyone. And of course, having been in Lincoln, and I'd lived in Waddington actually with a friend of my mother's for a couple of years, I knew so many people on the station. And so I went in there expecting to recognise a lot of people. And you know, I hardly recognised a soul until I took a second look. It was at the time when one of the famous speeches of Bomber Harris, "We will bomb Germany from end to end." And of course in 1942 there weren't the number of pilots then. And therefore they were going night after night. They'd aged so much in such a short time that really I had to do a sort of double take to recognise any of them. I recognised my husband there because he'd met me. I mean, I'm exaggerating. But really, I think people should realise just what a toll it took of those young men at that time. So that was my life in 1942.
Ask you, you're yes. talking about getting married in the war.
Yes.
What sort of wedding would you have had? Was it, could one talk of a typical wartime wedding?
I don't think mine was. I think you want to remember that I lived in 1940, from 40 to 42, in an area of the Air Force. We'd had a landmine in Waddington, which had destroyed quite a bit of the village. Fortunately, the great big church, because although it was only a village, like a lot of Lincolnshire, it had enormous churches. And the church had taken the brunt of it, so nobody was killed. But it meant that a lot of houses were damaged. And I lived with a friend of my mother's, well, it's a sort of very obscure friend, in a rather large house. Her husband was away, and she was glad to have me as a paying guest of company. And suddenly, we two women had a house full of people, because other houses were damaged. The squadron commander, his wife and baby came, and other people came. So really, we became almost a small hotel. And that gave me a lot of entree into the station there for parties and things like that. And while that may sound all very exciting, it was all very tragic as well. You would dance with somebody tonight, and the next day they wouldn't be there. I had a boyfriend in about 40, 41, a pilot officer, and we were going to meet in Lincoln. And he was a very reliable young man. I don't know that it would have been a romance, but he was a jolly good boyfriend. And we were going to meet for a quick snack and go to the pictures, and he didn't turn up. And so I rang up at the station, and I was told, almost as if it was sort of an everyday remark, "I'm sorry, so-and-so Thompson didn't return from operations last night." And you know, the awful thing was, for a minute, it wasn't the sense of tragedy that came first. It's, well, what do I do now? And I felt ashamed of thinking that. But to answer your question about the wedding, because I had seen that happen with so many people, I think my future husband and I thought, cut out the fuss. And we just went home and had a registry of his wedding. My mother was sad because she had a church wedding in the First World War, but she again didn't have a white wedding. A lot of people did. But I think it was just this feeling of, come on, let's snatch what happiness we can while we can. I suppose, really, I need not have gone on working at the Ministry of Food as I managed a serviceman. I would have brought myself back there. But, you know, it was a very, very demanding time. We had a lot of women in that house whose husbands were flying. And the first person awake, we used to count the Lancasters going out. And the first person who woke in the morning there used to rouse everybody else. I wasn't a wife then, but I had a husband-to-be. And we used to count the bombers coming back. I mean, we didn't necessarily know if, because it was private information or secret information, who exactly was flying where. But we knew if 12 bombers had gone out, we wanted to hear 12 Lancasters come back. We used to hear 6, 7, long pause. There's another one, 8. And so it really was very nerve-wracking, and I think probably all men felt it, the wives were better out of the way. But I'd taken on a good job, and I think we both felt, well, we both got a job to do, let's get on with it, but meet as often as we could. So mine was not a typical wartime wedding. I might say it was a pretty typical, perhaps, RAF wedding, because things happened very immediately there. Now, my brother was in the Merchant Navy, and he was married very early in 1943, and he did have a proper wedding. Bridesmaids and everything. Again, there were lots of difficulties. His best man never got back in time. And so an uncle had to step in and be best man. So I don't know if you can say there was a typical wartime wedding. I think people longed for proper weddings with orange blossom and white clothes. Looking back, I wished I'd had it, but at the time, one just wanted, as I say, to snatch what happiness there was. And with that in mind, almost the moment we got married, I became pregnant. So that I didn't last all that long in Cambridge. I stayed as long as I possibly could. And because Cambridge was the centre of the scientific part of the Ministry of Food, I got very much caught up in that, Bestie. I remember going with a scientist one day to check the vitamin C content of school cabbage. Because I think what a lot of people don't realise is that school meals began as a wartime measure. I mean, some schools had done a certain amount of food to feed people who'd come any distance, but it wasn't to feed all the children. But it was one of the very important things brought in by the Ministry of Food. And so we went to test this cabbage. Not quite sure what they thought I was going to do in it. I think I was holding a watching brief. And when the cabbage came up, and the scientists began to get up the test tubes and things, I thought, my friend, I don't think you need bother. Every atom of vitamin C has been boiled out of it, because we hadn't a clue about cooking vegetables properly. I say we hadn't a clue. That's an exaggeration. On the whole, the majority of people overcooked vegetables to an incredible degree. Your cabbage, if it started out of green, would end up a sort of pale grey colour and rather damp and limp. The idea of having it crisp and beautifully green really never occurred to people. As a sort of saving grace to help it perhaps not go such a ghastly colour, there was a belief that if you put a pinch of bicarbonate of soda in the water, it helped. All it did was to give a rather nasty taste. It certainly didn't help. So that's, I believe, was when the British people took a good look at how they cooked vegetables, and the Ministry of Food took a very hard look on how vegetables were cooked. And from then on, our theme song was, you must get your vitamins from eating raw vegetables, from eating correctly cooked vegetables. If I were giving a demonstration in the Ministry of Food, I would always have in front of me a very colourful plate of salad. And I have an idea that today people might shiver a little bit because we make very exotic salads today. But these were very down-to-earth salads. There would certainly be grated carrot, nothing very unusual about that. In wintertime, when lettuce weren't obtainable, there would be grated cabbage or Brussels sprouts or spinach. I smile today when raw spinach is fashionable, because I say, ha-ha, we knew about that 50 years ago, and urge people to do it. Then there will be grated raw swede. And people, when I tell them today, say, what? And I say, yes, very good, grated raw carrot. Tomatoes, of course, in season, but you want to remember that British tomatoes end about September and aren't seen again until May or June, so you have to make up for that vitamin C. So that was a very important lesson, and I don't think we've ever gone back in Britain to cooking vegetables as badly. I think we learnt that lesson, and that lesson has been passed on to future generations. So I came home, like everybody did when they were going to have a baby. And as my family would tell you, Marguerite's always in a hurry, so Marguerite managed to fall over and have her baby about 6 weeks ahead, which terrified everybody, because this poor little thing. Actually, she wasn't so little, because I learnt afterwards my husband's family went in for 11 and 12 pound babies, so Judith was not as little as it sounds, but she was very frail, and we had to look after her very carefully. Before I left the ministry, they said, is there any hope of you coming back? And I said, oh, I shouldn't think so, unless I get someone to look after the baby, because my mother was still teaching. My sister was at college training to be a teacher. Anyhow, after Judith was born and the first two or three months went past, I obviously was a nuisance at home. There wasn't enough to do. My mother had a small, compact house and had got help there. And of course, the moment you heard 20 of our bombers were missing, I was in a state of dither. And so my mother said, you know, really, it'd be much better if you could get yourself back. Well, I had very strong views on looking after children. And while there were British nurseries where you could put them, I really didn't feel happy about that, because Barnet had become not one of the major targets. It was too far out of London, but I knew I would have to go back and work in London or near London for the Ministry of Food, and it seemed to me that if I was going to be absent and my mother was going to be absent at school, I must have somebody in the home looking after my child. So I went to the Ministry of Labour and said, is there any hope of somebody to come in and look after my baby? And they sort of said, well, we've got this page, this page, this page, and turned about 20 pages. I'm afraid it doesn't look likely. So I went up to the Ministry of Food and saw them at headquarters, which was in London. The scientific division was in Cambridge, but the headquarters were in London. And I said to the chief of the Home Advice of Service, sorry, not a hope. And she said, I see, if you've got somebody, would you come back? And I said, yes, I would be delighted to come back. Well, this is one of the minor miracles, I think, or perhaps other people would say if it wasn't a miracle, it was just something done very cleverly. About a week after I went to the Ministry of Food, I'd been out shopping and mother was looking after the baby for me. When I came back, she said, you have a visitor here. So I went to see my visitor, and there was a trained nanny on the doorstep, a woman of just about my own age, unmarried, who couldn't be sent into factories because she suffered from asthma, who had an elderly mother, so she wanted to be at home with her. You see, there were all these ifs. You weren't ruthlessly gathered up in wartime. People listened if you had problems. And Dorothy, was the name of the nanny, had those particular problems. She had asthma very badly, and therefore where she worked was very important. She'd always worked with children. Why didn't they put her in a British nursery? I should never know. It was just my luck. And she had to get home to be with this elderly invalid mother. So with that, I went back to the Ministry of Food in London, North London, which was nearer to Barnet, and did a tremendous number of interesting demonstrations. Many of them were very much the sort of thing I'd done before. But I tended, again, with my background of dealing with grown-up people, and I suppose a little bit because of my short stage background, because I could cope with fairly restive audiences, to give demonstrations in the evening in all sorts of places. I remember one on the Isle of Dogs where we were full of a rather rowdy lot. People behave as if rowdiness is only today, not a bit of it. And the teenagers who came with or without their parents were pretty rowdy then. And the policemen who seemed to be on duty, I don't know why, and I worked out a splendid sort of scheme. I would take a plate of cakes. Oh yes, we taught people how to make cakes, to the door, and they would follow, and the policemen would give the rowdy ones a good heavy push in the small of their back, and out they'd go. So that settled that little lot. But I was beginning to get very worried because the bombing was intensive. Barnet was getting its share of things. I must qualify that and say nothing like a central London and the East End, but enough for me to worry that for my mother to be left in the evening. So I began to wonder what I would do. And then a strange thing happened, luck again. The Ministry of Food had had food advice bureaus in both Selfridges and Harrods. I'd done my term at staffing those from time to time for the Ministry. And they were closing them. I don't know why, but I heard it said that they felt that they should put the money and the staff into the East End, because the East End were taking terrible, terrible bombing, and perhaps it was all part of helping the people there, so that they were not going to staff either Selfridges or Harrods food advice bureaus anymore. I heard about this. And the Harrods, I don't know what happened to Selfridges, maybe they didn't protest, but Harrods protested. And they said, look, the people who come to our store want help just as much. So the ministry said, right, if you find someone of whom we approve, you can still call it the Ministry Advice Bureau. Harrods said, right, we will pay the somebody. And the ministry said, right, and if the somebody is ill, or when they go on holiday, we will put in somebody to take her place. And so I said, right, that's me. And the ministry said, no, 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 we don't mean you. And I said, well, I'm awfully sorry, but really, it is me. And of course, they couldn't stop me because, A, I had a serviceman as a husband and I had a baby. And this, again, is part of conscription, that there was always the thought that people would consider special needs. And they did indeed. So I took over the very end of 43, permanently, Harrods Ministry of Food Advice Bureau. People today are absolutely fascinated by the rations. This is leaping ahead to when I've written books and been at the Imperial War Museum, so perhaps I should go back to the rationing time. You see, rationing was in full force, or it had been since 40. From 40, gradually it came, 41, 42, 43, 44. We'd all got used to rationing, which didn't mean to say we enjoyed it, but we had learnt how to cope. What were our rations? They were 2 ounces of butter a week, 4 ounces of margarine or fat. You must remember that these could vary a little bit. If something happened that fat got difficult, it could be dropped. 2 ounces of cheese, which varied sometimes up, sometimes down. I'm coming back to cheese because other people got more than that. You had 1 and tuppenny worth of meat a week. Now, that's difficult to describe because you've got to think of the prices during the 40s and the prices of today in the 1990s. And I always compare that with 2 small lamb chops. That's about your ration for the week. What did you do the other days? Oh, well, you made do. But, of course, you didn't necessarily have chops. You might buy mincemeat, which was cheaper, and therefore you got more of it. But it was the one thing that wasn't rationed on price. Tea was rationed, just 2 ounces a week. It may sound a generous amount, but you want to remember we were great tea drinkers in those days. And if you've been up half the night, either air raid, warden, fire watching, or just sitting up in a shelter, you longed for a cup of tea. Preserves, they were very tough. They were £1 per person per 2 months. Sugar, half a pound a week. Now, that varied sometimes. In summer, we often got more so we could make jam. And people today say, oh, that's a lot of sugar. Really? You had to cook with it. You had to bake with it. You had to make preserves with it. Because remember, you'd only got that one precious jar of jam or marmalade every 2 months. What have I forgotten? Oh, eggs. Well, now, one egg a week, if you were lucky. That's an old-fashioned egg in its shell. One egg a fortnight, if you were unlucky. But then, of course, from America came dried eggs. And if you question a dozen people, you'll get varying replies as to how they felt about dried eggs. Some people love dried eggs. Oh, I wish we could have them back, they say. Other people say, oh, that ghastly dried egg. What did I think about them? To begin with, I thought they were awful. And then I realised it was my fault. And as somebody who was teaching the public, I had to show them how to use dried egg. We don't read instructions carefully enough. And the instructions said very clearly, 1 level tablespoon of dried egg powder, because that's what it was in a packet, a powder, to 2 tablespoons of water. And what we all tended to do was to use too much of the powder. And so we got an extraordinary sulphur taste, which was unpleasant. But if you made it up correctly, it was excellent. What could you use it for? Oh, scrambled egg, omelettes, in cakes, if you could spare it. 1 packet per person per month. So that was the equivalent of 12 eggs. So you still, that still wasn't, you see, you couldn't run amok with your, even your dried egg. Soufflés. Now, many people don't believe it today, and I'm quite sure a wartime soufflé with dried eggs doesn't bear comparison with one where you separate the yolks from the whites, but we hadn't got enough eggs for that. A lot of people kept chickens, even in town areas, so they got more eggs. I said I'd mention about cheese. If you were a vegetarian and you gave up your meat ration, you got extra cheese. Now, if you worked in the country as a on a farm, you got extra cheese. Why? Well, in towns, there were British restaurants. And British restaurants were really very special. I've heard the food described as typical of school food, and I suppose it was the same sort of thing. You could have very cheaply a substantial meal. I've heard other advantages about British restaurants. You lived by yourself. You were frightened. You were worried. Maybe your husband or your children are in the forces. A British restaurant was a wonderful place to go and meet people as well as to have a cheap meal. So that helped. You want to remember that many people had canteen meals. That helped. Children had school meals. That helped. So all in all, there were many other places where one could get food. What about restaurants? Ah, they were allowed to stay open. I read time and time again that like theatres and cinemas, when the government felt they were safe, they helped to boost morale. So you could go to a restaurant for a meal, but even if it was the grandest restaurant in London, you only paid 5 shillings, 25 pence. Wasn't that marvellous? Ah, yes, but wait for it. They were rationed too. And therefore, it was a fairly sparse meal. You could, of course, buy wine. And very smart restaurants could charge a cover charge of about 2 shillings, which, again, isn't much today, but was quite a little bit then. But there was an even distribution. You see, if you hadn't canteen, if you hadn't a school meals, if you didn't go to the British restaurant, you could go to an ordinary restaurant. So while the rations were sparse, and they took quite a lot of working out how to balance them and how to eke out with unrationed things, there were other ways that people could have food during those years. What about the unrationed food? Well, one of the big things that we made use of, I've already spoken of them, were vegetables. In summer, we had quite a lot of fruit. But in winter, just as tomatoes and lettuce and cucumber disappeared like magic in winter time, other fruits, we hadn't got citrus fruit, for example. That's what I think I miss more than anything. A very few oranges came into the country, but they were sold on children's ration books, and they were allowed £1 per ration book for small children. And most mums used to stick to that very carefully, but the peel wasn't rationed. Wasn't wasted. The peel used to come off, and we used to make oranges.